The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
And you're listening to Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, with News Dissector Radio every week at this time, 1 to 2, on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'm happy to be back, and we won't have a show next week, but this week we have some really great guests for you and some important ideas to share. So please hang out with us. The phone number to call in is 888-874-4888. Some of the material I talk about also appears in my blog at newsdissector.com/blog. So I'm happy to be here and happy to be with you. Sherry Welsh, are you with us?
Yes.
Well, there she is. That yes, don't you love that? Yes. What is that? Some sort of bleat, you know, from somewhere in the South? Okay, Sherry, thank you for being here. Before we introduce our guests, which we'll do in a second, I just want to take note of a little parallel, historical parallel, that I was musing about on the subway up here. You know, back in the days of Joe Stalin's Russia, they used to do an annual May Day parade, and the analysts, the Kremlinologists, would study the pictures of the people up on the rostrum there overlooking Red Square to decide who was in and who was out. And the Soviet people there had a way of erasing people from photographs that they didn't like, and that's how we know that these people are on the out. You know, basically, we don't want you to see their faces. They no longer exist. Goodbye. Well, I was reading Paul Krugman on the way up in the New York Times today, and he's talking about the Republican minority on the financial crisis inquiry commission, which is a poor substitute for a Pecora-style investigation. Pecora was the man during the Great Depression who investigated criminality on Wall Street, you know, flung subpoenas everywhere, cross-examined people harshly. A copy of the report, one of his reports, is available now from Cosimo Books, if you're interested. At any rate, this financial crisis inquiry commission was put together essentially as a kind of bipartisan effort. You know, let's all look at the financial crisis and let's not get too contentious about it. Well, now the Republicans, unhappy about what the report is likely to find, issued their own version to preempt the regular report this week. And apparently, according to Huffington Post and Paul Krugman, they demanded that four words be removed from the report. Very Soviet style, okay? The words were deregulation, shadow banking, interconnection, and yes, Wall Street. So in their report, these things don't exist, and neither do the arguments of any responsibility by the financial sector for what happened to our economy. At any rate, this is an issue, a theme that I've been raising in my blog and discussing, but it's just interesting to put it in this historical context of you know, essentially erasing history that you don't like, substituting your beliefs for facts. And that's what we have going on here. We'll be back in a second. We're going to be meeting with David Niewert, who's a freelance journalist based in Seattle, the managing editor of that great blog, Crooks and Liars. We're also going to be meeting Digby, who writes the blog Hullabaloo, chronicling American politics and culture, a really unique voice outer space. But what I mean is in the online world. So Digby will be joining us as well. You're listening to News Dissector Radio on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo.
Trust. So-
Okay, we're streaming live in the overheated studios at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, the third week with no water for the hosts, but it's not a complaint. That seems to resonate in the higher levels of program management here. It doesn't seem to matter, and I will manage to get through the program without that delicious water that they used to provide here. I think it was something about bottled water versus real water, and they just opted not to provide any. At any rate, joining us this morning, in addition to Ms. Sherry Welsh, whose voice you heard a few moments ago, is David Newert. He's a freelance journalist based in Seattle, managing editor of the blog Crooks and Liars. His reportage for MSNBC.com on domestic terrorism won the National Press Club Award for Distinguished Online Journalism in the year 2000. Hi, are you there, David? Hello, hello. David Newert, are you there?
Ah, hello there.
Okay. Just introducing you, man, talking about your latest book, The Eliminationists, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right, and I'd like to get into that. Also, along joining us as well is Digby. She of kind of a concealed identity, but that's okay, a writer of the blog Hullabaloo, where she's been chronicling American politics and culture for 8 years. She's been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn, and a writer whose political and cultural observations have entertained and informed the blogosphere since 2002. Her work can currently be found on Hullabaloo. So there you go. Two great guests, two really informed and interesting commentators on American life joining me today. Of course, the issue du jour seems to be the release, or is it a release, of Julian Assange in England. He's managed to win bail with tremendous restrictions, a very high bail at that. And I know, Digby, you've been following this closely, the whole Assange WikiLeaks saga. So what's the latest?
Well, thank you for having me, first of all. It's a pleasure to be here. The latest seems to be, and I think one of the more amusing aspects of it, and alarming, frankly, is the media's reaction to Julian Assange and the way that they've approached the whole issue of WikiLeaks, and specifically with Assange being released yesterday on bail, and he was, you know, released with an electronic bracelet, and he's ostensibly being held on these, you know, sexual molestation or rape charges from Sweden. But the thing that most commentators, and I was very surprised to see this, but they were all very concerned whether or not Assange was going to have access to the internet. And what that has to do with rape charges, I don't know. I guess they were afraid that he was going to, I don't know, make an assignation with someone. So clearly they've gotten very...
He wants to get on Match.com, his first... His first choice.
Exactly.
I mean, this is so absurd. It's disgusting. You know, here's somebody who's done a tremendous amount, taking great risks to provide information to the whole world that people didn't know about what was really going on the diplomatic front in terms of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and the like. And, of course, he quickly becomes the story. Instead of the stories he's actually breaking, you know, he's become the story. And so he's become the person that we now are supposed to be hating. The U.S. government apparently is in the midst of a grand jury in Virginia hoping to indict him under the Espionage Act or under some conspiracy statute for his so-called dealings with Bradley Manning, who is right now being held in prison in Guantanamo-like conditions for releasing, a lot of these documents or data, however you want to describe them, and yet the media is pouncing on Assange. It's interesting the other day that Naomi Wolf, unearthed a document from 2 years ago from Sweden, which was a report by Amnesty International, showing that the Swedish government has a terrible record of following up on real rape and real sexual abuse. While the laws are very positive, the enforcement there is not. So this is clearly a selective enforcement, and Assange's lawyer says it's a holding action to try to keep him, you know, in the criminal justice system so that the American government can now pounce and seek his extradition. Is that your reading of it as well?
It is. Now, you know, I don't want to discount the, you know, the charges standing on their own. You know, you have to take charges seriously.
Agree with that.
That does seem to be, you know, something that falls under Swedish law as a very serious crime. And so just setting that aside, however, you cannot divorce this from the circumstances under which he is being charged. And, you know, there's a long history of this sort of thing. It seems, I think anyone who isn't very, very skeptical of this entire process is being very foolish. I mean, it's clear that they want to keep him in custody. Now, whether or not they're able to contrive some, you know, criminal behavior on his part is really unknown at this point. There are a lot of constitutional scholars and various experts in the area who think that they can't. That, you know, my personal feeling is that the government can probably always come up with something if they want to. But, you know, to try and extradite him under some espionage statute seems pretty far-fetched to me. From what I've read, that doesn't seem likely, although there is this question now of whether or not they can find a way to prove that he was conspiring with Manning to actually physically remove these files. They could find some, you know, some area, I guess, under the Patriot Act that they could charge him under. Now, you know, how, why the press is so, you know, at the best, they're complacent about this, and at worst, they're cheering on the government.
Yeah, which is amazing.
It's shocking, really, because, I mean, this is regardless of what you think of Assange as a person, and regardless of whether or not these crimes he's accused of in Sweden are true, there's a, you know, a really fundamental threat to freedom of the press here. And the idea that they, you know, many of them rose to defend Judy Miller for protecting her sources of, you know, her powerful government sources, and at this point are not rising up to, at the very least, protect the principle under which Assange is operating.
Well, it goes even further than that, doesn't it, Digby? I mean, David, as reading the title of your book again, you know, The Eliminationists, how hate talk radicalized the American right. I mean, there are people on the American right who, you know, don't even want to go to a trial phase. They want to execute him right away, you know, like Alice in Wonderland style. First the verdict, then the trial.
Right. Well, Sarah Palin wanted him hunted down like Osama bin Laden, and several, I think Jonah Goldberg and a couple of, I'm not sure who else.
Well, Mike Huckabee, for one, I don't know.
Called for him to be assassinated.
Yeah, I don't know if John Stewart had Huckabee on last night, basically talking about the 9/11 first responder issue, which he was very eloquent about last night, but he was going to throw up on the web, as he likes to. We'll throw it up on the web, you know. You know, this kind of inferior form. And somebody should remind John that a new study just came out showing that fully half the population relies on the web for news and information and not on television. But nevertheless, I don't know if he raised this question with Huckabee or not. I haven't seen the full interview.
Yeah, I just
watched it. He didn't raise it with him. Yeah, but I'd like to add the 9/11 thing.
In other words, he just stated on the 9/11 issue showing Republican hypocrisy. But here's a guy who's actually called for an extrajudicial murder of somebody based on, you know, an assumption that he's somehow guilty of a major crime, which nobody really can define.
Yeah, which is, the right-wingers want to define as treason, which is pretty funny for a non-American citizen to be accused of treason. But anyway.
Well, Joe Lieberman said that as well. I mean,
yeah,
isn't a right-winger, but...
Well, what's interesting also on this, and we'll move on to your book and other issues as well, but what's interesting about all this is the Australian public is getting really peeved with the way that one of their citizens is being treated. There was a full-page ad in the New York Times and in newspapers around the world from mm-hmm. Australia, and they're critical of their own government for not standing behind Assange's rights, and also, furious at the American government for its arrogance. And, you know, this is essentially a public rendition that's going on. We're in the early stages of it.
Yeah. Do you remember do you know much about, remember Big Bill Haywood? Bill Haywood, the IWW.
The IWW, which stands for International Workers of the World for the Uninitiated.
He had to stand trial back in 1907 under really similar circumstances. It was kind of bizarre. The parallels between this, he and Charles Moyer, the other IWW head, were basically abducted from Denver back to Idaho with habeas corpus suspended. They used perjured extradition papers, the whole nine yards, to spirit them from Denver out to Idaho to stand trial for Frank Stunenberg's murder. And it was a maneuver that, I mean, when I heard about the, basically watched what was going on with Assange, it's really similar to that. They're just using every little, any pretext they can to basically get him into an American prison.
This is a sort of
it's appalling.
No, it's
well, did you see where Daniel Ellsberg got arrested yesterday at the protest in D.C. with Christopher Hedges and everybody to protest what's going on with Assange?
No, I didn't know that.
Well,
it was also an anti-war protest, and so they put everybody down. Colleen Rowley, everybody was there. But I wanted to ask David about all of this hate-filled calling for Assange to be murdered when nobody even knows what Danny's point was and what Digsby's talked about. He hasn't even gone to trial yet. Nobody even really knows what's happened. And the right wing is calling for him to be murdered, these good Christians.
Well, the right wing in America has been, as my book kind of explains, and actually The Eliminationist is actually my previous book. I've got a new book out called that I co-wrote with John Amato called Over the Cliff, How Obama's Election Drove the American Right Insane. And detail this even further, that basically the right wing in America, the conservative movement, has become extremely radicalized in the last 8 years. And it's really getting out of hand, and it's happened so gradually that I don't think people really recognize it. But fundamentally, the Tea Party movement, as far as I can see, is not a great deal different than the Patriot movement to the militia movement of the 1990s. There's certainly powerful strands between them, and they certainly behave the same. Most importantly, they believe things that are provably untrue. And, their solution for everything is just kill them all and let God sort it out.
They aren't armed as far as we know, although obviously there have been supporters of theirs who've showed up at events with weapons, and they're supporting legislation that allows you to carry weapons in the open and all the rest, right?
Sure. Well, we also had the case in Oakland where this guy, the Glenn Beck fan, was going to go shoot up the Tides Foundation because he had been watching too much Glenn Beck. He was on his way when the police pulled him over, and he had a car full of guns and weapons and various armaments, it's becoming, and this is part of the problem, and I think one of the things that shows up in the Assange case is the utter failure of mainstream media to sit up and take notice and say, hey, people, this is what's going on. I mean, it's really a disgrace how the mainstream press is behaving towards Assange, because, as you've all pointed out, this is something that really does have powerful implications for the freedom of the press.
Well, the Personal Democracy Forum had a session last weekend with a lot of internet specialists and journalism critics and the like to discuss all of this. They had two panels. They were streaming it. It was quite interesting. And Jay Rosen, who's a media analyst, critic, writer, and professor at NYU, basically said what we're seeing is that the watchdog function of the mainstream media is dead or dying.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in a sense, the New York Times, even as it tried so hard to separate itself from Assange and carried an article really impugning his integrity and the rest, which was pretty disgraceful. Nevertheless, couldn't wait to be able to break these documents because they're not doing any real digging on their own. And
right.
You know, this is a part of the problem. I mean, we're now getting documents released by agencies. I mean, the Federal Reserve Bank released documents, you know, showing trillions of dollars that we didn't even know about, basically given off to banks and corporations, including GE, and no reporting on it whatsoever. And it was only because of the financial reform bill, which the Republicans now want to gut, that they were actually forced in some way to reveal this information. There's an interesting YouTube video, which I put in my blog at onmediachannel.org, Alan Grayson speaking to the person at the Fed who's in charge of investigating, kind of the inspector general of the Federal Reserve Bank. And, you know, he asked her, you know, have you looked into this? Are you looking into this? Are you planning to look into this? No, 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 was basically the response. In fact, she didn't even know about it. He was citing an article carried by Bloomberg, a business news service, that she hadn't read. So, I mean, these are the people who are asleep at the switch, you know, or maybe deliberately so. And now who's going to wake them up, it's interesting, is Ron Paul, who's now the chairman of the committee overseeing the Federal Reserve Bank. And I'm sure he's not going to give them an easy time in terms of disclosure and accountability and the like.
Right. Well, Ron Paul, of course, has a history of that.
Right.
A lot of it from the radical right, quite frankly.
Right. But he's their worst nightmare. I mean,
yeah,
Ben
yeah.
Bernanke, you know, I'm sure when he heard that the person who was going to be doing the oversight on his agency, Ron Paul, began to, like, shake a little bit, you know. I don't know if you saw his interview on 60 Minutes. You know, he was talking about how, well, we can't expect any more jobs for 5 years. He was sort of, his lips were shaking. He seemed to be a mess, you know. And I think the people who are trying to reassure us are not reassured themselves.
Yeah.
So, Digby, you know, in terms of all of this, it's not just the, quote, unofficial information that we're getting. It's the official information that we're getting. I mean, these reports yesterday on Afghanistan showing, you know, how everything is going swimmingly, you know, contradicted, you know, internally by the observations of people on the scene who say, you know, we're not making any progress at all. And yet this is the headline is saying it's a sign of approval.
Well, I think that really gets to the what's, to me anyway, the most interesting thing about the whole Assange issue and just, you know, the subject that we're covering. And that is that, you know, we've reached a point, I think. I mean, there's an awful lot of information out there. It's very hard to filter it. People find different ways of doing that. But what we're dealing with is a breakdown in trust in institutions across the board. And we have at the same moment this new way of disseminating information. I mean, it's uncontainable. The idea that they can put Assange in jail and that will mean anything is hilarious. It's absurd. There's no shutting down the internet. All of world commerce and communication depends on it. That's not going to happen. They're not going to be able to do that. Go ask the recording industry about how easily you can contain this, you know, put that genie back in the bottle once it's out there. So that's absurd. And the idea that this information is getting out, it is as much a reaction to our you know, loss of trust and faith in institutions and leadership as it is a consequence of it. This is going to be happening. The only answer to it is more transparency, not less. The idea that you have these headlines on the New York Times this morning about how, you know, Afghanistan, we're really very enthusiastic, it's going forward, and we're very hopeful, and at the same time you can turn to any website or listen to a radio show like this on the internet and hear competing and truth-telling from others who are in the know is this whole system is breaking down, and they have to recognize that.
Sometimes,
look at yesterday, they arrested 131 veterans, kept these people that were protesting the wars with Dr. Margaret Flowers, former CIA officer Ray McGovern and Daniel Ellsberg out there for 4 hours in the freezing cold because they were protesting the war. And now Daniel Ellsberg and McGovern are going to go on trial for disobeying a lawful order. And the other people were all let go. But 131 veterans were arrested.
Well, you know, this is a turn towards repression. When they don't know what to do, they go into their toolkit, you know, of historical toolkit, that goes back, you know, in early days of American history, you know, as you pointed out before, David, you know, of just repression. You know, the facts are what we say they are, and it doesn't really matter what happened. It's the impressions. And this is one of my worries, Digby. I'm trying to figure this out. You know, all of these cables, you know, they've been staggered in their release. So probably only about 7% have come out so far, or 9% of, you know, hundreds of thousands of documents, okay? First, you've seen on the left people who are already, willing to believe that Assange is a CIA agent because, you know, he hasn't exposed Israel or he hasn't exposed some other issue that they're particularly concerned about. So they basically spin it in the direction of what's, you know, the glass is half empty. It's not even, you know, full. It's complete. It's compatible with what the ruling class wants, et cetera, and so forth. On the other hand, the documents that do come out often require context and background. You know, you can't understand some of these issues unless you know something about the country and the issues in the country. And this is one of the things that's very worrisome, that all of this information can come out and have zero impact because the media and the readers and viewers are so uninformed about what's happening. So somebody does a more textured, you know, look at some sort of policy decision, they don't know what to make of it.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting that you bring that up because Assange himself said recently, I mean, you're aware, obviously, and I don't know that most people are, that these cables were not just released out on, these latest cables were not just released out onto the Internet. And they were being released slowly in conjunction with five newspapers, all highly regarded newspapers around the world that WikiLeaks worked with. Now, the New York Times gave themselves a degree of separation by working not directly with WikiLeaks on this batch of releases, but rather working through The Guardian from Great Britain. But, you know, most people are, and everybody, and the American press has been terrible about this too, and just disseminating incorrect information. This is not getting it wrong. I honestly believe they're doing this on purpose, which is giving the impression that they just released 260,000 cables with no,
like,
you know,
a big dump.
It's out there.
A big dump. Right,
a big dump, and that's not what happened. And Assange said recently that the reason for it was just what you said, was that when they did the earlier releases, they had sort of hoped that crowdsourcing would put these things in context. You know, I mean, the sort of modern version of you know, you put enough people on a story that you'll eventually be able to get the context. Experts will weigh in. There'll be a whole, you know, kind of organic way to have this information put into the proper context and find its way out into the general public, and he found that that didn't happen. And so I think that there's a slight misunderstanding about his approach. I shouldn't say his. This is WikiLeaks. It's not just him, but the group that's doing this. That we weren't really ready for that. And
yeah, well,
so
they need to work with
journalists.
Right. If they did do the dump, it would be like a one-day story. Nobody would get any of the information. It would be something that just inundated us in a way that we basically couldn't cope with. I think what they're trying to do is very sophisticated and important. But again, even his partners, and the New York Times is a good example, you know, that called him defiant today. And it made me think, I wrote in my blog, you know, I said, why isn't the New York Times defiant, you know?
No kidding. I mean, one of the most amazing things that I saw recently was the interview with Bill Keller, and a former diplomat from Great Britain who were being interviewed on the BBC. And Bill Keller, you know, they're questioning Keller about, you know, how are you dealing with this? And he said, well, you know, no one should worry. We're running all these cables past the White House and getting their advice.
Yeah, complete collusion. Complete collusion. I mean,
and here's the diplomat saying to to Bill Keller saying, well, geez, I guess I'd go directly to the WikiLeaks site rather than read the New York Times.
Right, exactly.
Because clearly you're not going to release the true story on this. So, I mean, the New York Times has disgraced itself on this, really.
Well, that's, I think the answer, or an answer, for listeners might be to go to the Guardian website in London and, you know, follow the story there, because they're far less constrained or self-censored, is perhaps a better word, for how the New York Times covers these things. It's very troubling. We see it again. You know, this is the paper that published the Pentagon Papers in full, okay? And in these documents, they're selective about it. They're selecting out documents that seem to basically buttress American foreign policy claims, like the need for an attack on Iran and the like. That's the documents they've chosen, even though that some of those documents, the way they were presented, according to various experts, basically suggesting the Arab world wants to bomb Iran. It turns out not to be the case when you really read the documents. So all of this is done for sort of perception, for impression, for image, not really for information. That's what's so frightening. When we come back, David, I would like to chat with you a little bit about Crooks and Liars and this website, which has so much influence and so many people turning to, that's been consistently exposing a lot of these issues. And also, Digby, your own writing. I'm interested in how you choose subjects and the like. We have to take a little break here on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. We're going to introduce you to a new song from my film Plunder by a fellow named Bill Shipper, who calls himself an analyst, a singing analyst. And the CD is called Dirty Data. And the song, which appears in my film Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, Nobody Wants My Debt Anymore.
Pale. All the big banks are gonna fail. Too many bad mortgages for sale. Nobody wants my debt anymore. Well, the court judge just locked my door. My 401k is okay and no more. Can't we get Greenspan back like before? Nobody wants my debt anymore. Well, the real estate bubble got me in trouble back in 2006. I need help on the double, I hate to grovel, but it's nothing a couple hundred billion won't fix. I ain't asking for carte blanche. You can start with just one tranche.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is Orly Cotell with Sierra Club Radio. Tune in Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com to hear interviews with green authors, activists, politicians, celebrities, and more.
Hi, I'm Sandra B. Tate, and I'm here with a few success tips for the holidays. Don't be too hard on yourself by comparing who you are with others. Let it be a time of self-renewal, sharing smiles, and being grateful in the first place. All you have to do is take a look at today's news, and you will be reminded how fortunate you really are. Among all the things in life, you have loved ones, the festive spirits of giving, and the thoughts of your actions for the future that will lighten your path to success. Of course, having a grateful heart and a focused mind will open opportunities you thought were closed. So, eat, drink, and enjoy those who choose to be here with you at this special time. Being alone is just not an option. For more of these thoughts, join me at Success Power Talks every Saturday at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you can call in, comment on, and share your success thoughts for a greater living. Oh, one more thing. Have a happy, safe, and great holiday season. You deserve it.
to the Progressive Radio Network, celebrating 5 years of independent points of view.
I wanted to come back with this song, Can We Go Higher by Nina Bach. This was a song written at the height of the Balkan War, try to stop the war, asking all sides, can we go higher? Can we transcend the hatred and the violence in the country? Nina is a musician of conscience and a friend of mine. He's going to be performing a Sunday night at the Mercury Lounge on the Lower East Side. So this is Nina Bach asking an important question. Can we go higher?
To the sun. No rain of understanding. The little well. Centuries and days have gone with the ringing of a bell. Here we are. And here we are.
Can we go higher? A question that Nainad raises that we all really have to address. The other day I was sharing with him the, loving obituaries for Richard Holbrooke. In the New York Times today, there's another column of praising this great diplomat. But when you meet people from the former Yugoslavia on all sides, the one thing that seems to unite them is a dislike of Richard Holbrooke and the Dayton agreements that really didn't resolve the problems, in the region. Even though he's hailed here as a great diplomatic hero, there he's looked on by some even as a war criminal. So, again, it's your perspective on things that makes the difference. David, what is the perspective of Crooks and Liars? Tell us more about what you do there.
Well, basically what we specialize in is surveying the TV landscape, the TV media landscape, and running clips of people lying as much as we can, and we point out how they're lying. We also catch a lot of gaffes and hypocrisy and things like that, and so we like to put it up. We're a proudly liberal website, and we'd make no bones about that.
So crooksandliars.com, what is one of your recent stories that you're really proud of?
Well, probably the piece that we've been working on the hardest has been has just been kind of the continuing coverage of the Tea Party, and we've also been working pretty hard on getting the Dream Act passed. We do get involved in advocacy, so we've been working hard to get people to get out their senators to vote for the Dream Act, as well as to we're pushing hard for filibuster reform this coming January 5th. So. Those are the kind of things that are on our current.
Well, I'd like to be supportive of that in my blog, in newsdissector.com/blog, and really respect the work you've done. David Nywert, I think I mispronounced your name about 12 times.
Okay.
Forgive me. I can see Sherry Welsh in my mind's eye kind of giving me, nodding.
That's pretty amazing.
There he goes again, et cetera, and so forth.
David, I wanted to ask you a question. What got you into blogging, and how did you start Crooks and Liars? It's one of my favorite blogs.
I didn't start Crooks and Liars by any means. I have only been working there a couple of years. It was created. It's a creation of my co-author with the last book. His name is John Amato. John's a brilliant guy, and he came up. He's the guy who basically invented video blogging. He is the one who came up with the first the code to embed video blogs or videos on your blog, and it took off dramatically. But what's kept Crooks and Liars going all along is that John and I are both working class guys. We have very much a working class liberal's perspective
on things, and I think we speak for ordinary people. So, and that's very much our perspective. You know, we like to go out there and expose the people who are lying and being crooks. And
there you go. Well, you know, I'm hoping, David, when we have this ready, that you guys will support our efforts to promote a jail out, not a bailout, of Wall Street criminals, because there's been so few prosecutions of wrongdoers here. Amazingly enough, after the SNL crisis, 1,500 banksters went to jail. After this one, virtually none. And this is something that is really something we have to address. And I'm glad to hear about your working class background, because I share it, and I also want to see more activism on behalf of ordinary Americans. Digby, talk to me about how you got into all of this.
Well, I've been a political junkie my whole life, and followed politics very closely. And when the internet came along, and it was sort of coincided for me, my involvement in the internet, when the political system went fairly crazy at the end of the 1990s. I started impeaching presidents and stealing elections and, you know, that sort of thing. So I was writing online, and basically when blogging started, I was there pretty early and started my blog, and have been carrying on ever since. Just basically, talking about what I'm seeing, and I do something a little differently than they do at Crooks and Liars. I do all my own writing. I'm the only writer on my site, although I have had some wonderful contributors over time. but I'm basically the one, and I observe what's going on and offer an ongoing narrative of American politics in our time, I guess is the best way to put it, and try to put things in context and draw lines and connect dots.
Speaking of connecting lines and dots, could you talk a little bit about the maps that you put up about the disparity of the wealth with all of these tax cuts and everything, that you had those interactive maps that the New York Times did?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think is most disturbing, and again, this is interesting because we all talk a lot about the media. I think everybody on this call is close observers of the political media. And one of the ongoing frustrations for me is the fact that the media, who, you know, pretty, you know, most of the celebrity pundits who opine about, how everyone should have shared sacrifice and we all need to kick in and we all need to do what we need to do to fix the deficit, et cetera, are all, very, very successful people at the very top of the food chain. And there's this perspective that comes out of the political media that, my personal sort of view of the way these people see themselves is middle class. They're definitely not middle class. They're not living in a middle class world. They're not part of a middle class existence. And I'm not talking about cultural issues here, like the heartland or any of that stuff. I'm basically just, saying just the basic class divisions there. They're not part of it, and they don't speak from that perspective authentically, and yet they sort of present themselves as doing so. And it's one of the conventions of political media that's most frustrating to me. So as we've been seeing them talk over the last few days about these tax cuts and how, making arguments about how it's, we've all got to kick in together here for the deficit and blah, 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 you look at these maps, which the New York Times, they do some good things. Let's not forget that. They had put together these interactive maps with Google Maps, I think, which showed where the wealth is in this country. And the fact is that when you look at these maps and the way they're spread out, the vast majority of people make less than $50,000 a year. I mean, this is just that's the way it is. That's the way average people live. Certainly, very, very, very few people make over $250,000 a year. This, we know it's 2%, but when you see it spread out in this sort of, in map form on how the wealth is spread in this country, it's patently obvious that when they're talking about shared sacrifice, what they're talking about is, the looming cuts in Social Security, which is being set up by this entire, political gamesmanship they're doing with the deficit. And that the people who will suffer are people who are actually, they desperately need that money. That is, their retirement depends on it. And further cuts in all kinds of government services. We're going to see this in the next Congress, and it's going to be a battle royale. And after watching what just happened with these tax cuts, there are a lot of us who are very, very skeptical as to whether or not the Democrats are going to be able to hold fast and not allow them to start ripping away at the safety net. And yet it's a safety net, particularly now in this economic climate, which is, you know, essential to a vast number of Americans to just keep their heads above water. So, I mean, that's what I was getting at, and it's part of my, you know, I have an ongoing theme that I write about, which is about this kind of disconnect between the political elites and the people that they serve, and, you know, particularly among the media, who even less than politicians who from time to time do have to have a town hall meeting. You know, I think a lot of the elite media are so out of touch that they're presenting what essentially winds up being an alternative narrative of American culture that people see on TV. And I think it's very disorienting, and I think it is a large, you know, reason, it's a big part of the reason why people have so much trouble sort of understanding what's going on and being able to grasp how they can engage, because they're seeing something that is basically completely, you know, it runs on a sort of parallel track to their real lives, but it's as if it's a kind of a mirror image rather than a real image. Anyway, that was my thinking. Like,
well, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people are not really well informed about how the transfer of wealth has been accelerated, you know, with 1%, you know, of the population controlling 70% of the returns to wealth, you know, in the country, that the inequality is growing dramatically. And in the background, of course, are the people who want to blame the poor and cut when it comes to other people, but not themselves. And their voices are so conspicuously absent. That's why I was impressed last night when John Stewart had a panel of first responders, a fireman, an operating engineer, you know, police officer, you know, who were talking in like New York ease, you know, New York working class, you know, accents about what they experienced, and their voices are just absent from most of the television media, who just have the same people on day after day, you know, week after week. You know, it's all very predictable dribble and babble. And, you know, the reality of how most people lead their lives in America is rare in the media. And I think that's one of the points that you make here, Digby, that's really important that people hear. You know, not only are you a good writer, but you're also a passionate person. I think that's important. It's that is the reason why we do this in a way, because we're hoping to reach people. We're hoping to show people some small degree of solidarity with what they're experiencing in their lives, right?
Exactly. And I thought that segment on The Daily Show was really powerful. It's going viral on the web today. I put it up on my blog. I think Crooks and Liars did too, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, we just
or
put it up.
Preparing to. Yeah, it was really powerful, and it's exactly as you say. I mean, what it does is fly in the face of, I mean, it's more than just telling authentic stories of real people. I mean, that should be done. It's obviously something that is sorely lacking in the media. But this was a little bit different because basically it was Stewart, who does media criticism, was holding this up and saying, look, this is a story here that just a few years ago, I mean, this story of the 9/11, these were the heroes of 9/11. These were the people that were being extolled across the spectrum, but particularly on the right as being, you know, the epitome of American, you know, heroics. And here, now they're being completely tossed to the side, completely ignored, and the media is not paying any attention. It's as if they don't exist, and these are real people. I mean, these are actual human beings, and they're not, you know, you can't say that they're just bleeding heart liberals, you know, trying to, you know, benefit the poor or whatever. I mean, you can't fit them into the stereotype.
I mean, John Stewart broke his own format in doing that. We haven't seen that before, a panel of real people, no jokes, you know, a reality sandwich. And, you know, I think it's very important. Now, this is an issue that you know, clearly has a partisan intent, you know, to show the Republicans, you know, have abandoned them. But also, he also talked about the Democrats being asleep at the switch, not seizing this issue, which would have really given them more moral force in the political debate.
Well, exactly. As we're coming into this debate here about, I mean, this is political malpractice on the part of the Democrats, not simply because it's heartless to let these people flounder, but it also just because they have a responsibility to prepare themselves for the battle that's to come. And this was one way for them to start preparing the ground. I can guarantee you the Republicans would have, because they're actually very good at this. They understand that they have an ability to take sort of symbolic moments and turn them into overarching narratives. This is the overarching,
which they've done with 9/11, by the way, endlessly.
That's what they did. Exactly.
Endlessly.
And now they're abandoning it, now that it's not useful to them in this context.
If you think of all
and
the airtime about this nun mosque near Ground Zero, compare it to the lack of airtime, to the plight of these people, it's really a disgrace. And also, who's responsible for this? Who said go out there? Rudy Giuliani really deserves to be pilloried for his role in all of this. You know, so this didn't just happen where they came and, helped. You know, they were encouraged to do so. They were saluted politically. They were a symbol of support in a way for the war and for the Bush administration, etc. So,
well, Bush's greatest symbol was standing on that rubble with the bullhorn, with his arm around a fireman. I mean, that was
right. So exactly, it was a way of using, you know, people who were really sincere for your own purposes. And you know, I think Stewart debunked some of that last night in a very effective way. And, you know, I was glad to see it. But it also showed you how little coverage there's been of the issue and how few people from working class backgrounds ever get on television.
Well, absolutely. And those guys were great. I mean, they were very, very powerful. Of course, all of them are suffering from horrible illnesses, which just breaks
apart. They'll all be dead soon. David, you were going to say something?
Oh, I was just going to chime in on the Democrats' failure here and point out, I'm sure this is something Digby and I, we've all talked about at various times, that, you know, this is Democrats trying to be postpartisan or a rise above partisanship, right? I think they've been reading or breathing their own exhaust on this stuff because it's becoming toxic to them.
And I think they're breathing hopium.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Sherry's been talking about, you know, reviving the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like somehow we have to go from this posture of sort of protest and whining to some sort of organizational model that could reach out to the people of whom there are many who want to really support us. And I see a big failure here, you know, that the grassroots is useful in terms of raising money to the Democratic poobahs, but it doesn't seem to be useful in terms of its ideas or its energy or its political values.
Or what they actually believe in. Well, and it's part of the larger dynamic and part of what I've done over the years. Now, I actually started blogging at about the same time Digby did back in
Guys,
January
I started
2003.
Before you.
Yeah. No. I think she and I started that at exactly the same time.
Yeah.
We were actually, I think, encouraged by the same person to start blogging. So, and my perspective was that I was working as a guy from Idaho who had been a journalist in northern Idaho and been dealing with the extremist right there for many years in western Montana. And a lot of what has always interested me is the way working class people in rural America, and particularly in places like Idaho and Montana, will so clearly vote against their own best interests. And a lot of it has to do with these cultural issues and the way the right very skillfully manipulates people's sentiments on cultural issues. The result has also been a lot of extremism. As you know, in northern Idaho, we've had quite a bit of extremism over the years, particularly white supremacists and neo-Nazis. And
I wonder, David, if this whole extremist label, which used to, you know, sort of be affixed really on the, you know, on the militia people and, mm-hmm. you know, more fanatical people, couldn't also now be used sort of for the mainstream of some of these members of Congress, you know, who are completely, you know, imbued with those values and that kind of contempt for ordinary people, that kind of attitude of hostility and frustration and, you know, if not racist, certainly close to it, haters, let's put it that way. And, you know, they're haters not just of blacks, but of, you know, of anyone who disagrees with them.
Of anything that has even the slightest hint of liberalism about it. And this is why, you know, ultimately I get down to this argument that the big difference between the right and the left in this country is that when the right gets the left gets ugly, it kind of shouts a lot. And when the right gets ugly, they go out and kill people. And that's, and think about it. I mean, that's, you hear a lot of whining, you know, there was this whole New Black Panther case and so on and so forth from the Glenn Becks and people like that, that supposedly were, left is full of all these vicious radicals. But the reality is that when you look at the record over the last 20 years, we've had this endless series of small acts of violence. In which people get killed. In some cases, in 1995, we had a very major act of violence in Oklahoma City. But it's this endless drumbeat of people going out and, you know, bombing the Olympic Park and abortion clinics, shooting abortion doctors.
As H. Rap Brown once said, you know, violence is as American as apple pie. You know, I want to thank you, David and Digby, for joining us today and having this discussion, which I found quite interesting and important. And I think for those who don't know your work, they should check you out because you're important voices. You know, in our culture now, helping us understand more deeply what's happening to us, which is a lot, you know, so to speak. So I'd like to thank you again for being with us, and also Sherry, who's been really instrumental to this program as the year comes to an end, and we're not going to be here next week or on New Year's weekend, so and not because of the Republican lack of desire to work on Christmas, you know, but because the network is giving the people who work here a little time off, which they deserve. So we won't be back, but we'll be with you in spirit. I want to thank you again, Sherry, for helping to organize this program every week and doing such a fabulous job as a producer and a seducer of talent and bringing them on the program. I want to thank all of the listeners who are listening and who know that this program will be available as a podcast on iTunes and also on the PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com website later today. And also that you can follow the ideas that drive my particular passions in News Dissector, the News Dissector blog, newsdissector.com/blog, on mediachannel.org, which we're proud to say is going to be able to survive into the new year. We don't know how much longer, but we want to thank the people who have contributed and supported our nonprofit mission, which goes back to 1999. And also, we want to close today with the theme song of my film, Plunder. And you'll hear in the song the actual voice of Bernard Madoff, who's very much in the news because of the tragic suicide of his son. We've just heard today breaking news, you know, that some billions of dollars have been recovered by the people who are investigating what happened to the money, although, you know, the total of $65 billion is unlikely to be achieved. But there's nobody out there trying to recover money for the homeowners and the workers who have lost their retirement plans and their 401ks and all the rest of it. So we're in a country in desperate straits, and we're trying to do what little we can to let a little light in. This is Plunder by Polarity One. Tune in and listen again.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong. In criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off workers laid off.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets, and empty shops, and bank walking AAA.